Green Journal Editor's Picks podcast, a monthly discussion with Dr. Nancy Cheshire around featured papers from the current edition of the journal. Welcome to the June 2017 edition of Green Journal Editor's Picks with Dr. Nancy Cheshire, Editor-in-Chief of Obstetrics and Gynecology. I'm Dr. Fisher. Welcome, Dr. Cheshire.
Hey, Dr. Fisher, how are you doing?
Doing great. I'm a little excited. We've got a new feature on the podcast today. We've invited Dr. Shitanshu Uphall from Michigan, who's an author on one of our editor's picks this month, to give us a little background and insight into his paper on the incidence and timing of thromboembolic events in ovarian cancer patients undergoing neoadjuvant chemotherapy. And we also wanted to thank Dr. Uphall publicly because he's given us some great technical advice on how to improve the sound quality of the podcast. So hopefully all of our listeners are noticing some of his efforts in trying to make us a better podcast.
Yeah, I wanted to echo that and also encourage others who have comments on how we can improve either the technical side or the topics we're covering or new innovations like we're doing today. Please let us know.
Welcome, Dr. Uphall. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. First of all, thank you very much for giving me this opportunity. I'm a big fan of the podcast and excited to be here.
Well, great. We are excited to have you. Would you mind just giving us kind of a brief overview of your paper and maybe some of the things that drove you to do the research and then publish it?
Well, absolutely. So this paper, first of all, before I go any further, I just want to give a big shout out to Patricia Greco, who's the first author on this. She's a resident who's completing her residency this year, and she did a wonderful effort in getting this together during her difficult and busy, labor and delivery, GYN, gynecology rotations. I'm really proud of what we were able to accomplish together.
And she did a great
job.
That's
great. Great.
So this is a retrospective cohort study, which is mainly a descriptive paper, which came out of our observation that patients who were receiving chemotherapy in neoadjuvant setting, which is prior to undergoing surgery in ovarian cancer patients, we noticed that they were having a lot of pulmonary embolism and DVT episodes. So we decided to look back and objectively measure what these numbers were, and we went back for about 5 years, and we included patients who had ovarian cancer, fallopian tube cancers, and primary peritoneal cancers who received their treatment at the University of Michigan Cancer Center. What we found was that we had 125 patients. From there on, we excluded patients who were given neoadjuvant chemotherapy because they experienced a PE or a DVT, which excluded them from undergoing a long surgery. That was about 13 patients. And from the remaining 112 patients, we found a very high incidence of DVT-PE in these patients throughout their treatment course, which included the first three cycles of chemotherapy, surgery, and the adjuvant three cycles after surgery. 26.8% of the patients developed some sort of VTE during this time frame. We further broke down this episodes of VTE based on the phase of care. We found that about 11.6% of the patients experienced a VTE during the first three cycles of chemotherapy before surgery. Another 5% after surgery, which we all know as the post-operative phase, which is under the quality metrics. And then another 10% of the patients developed VTE during the next three cycles of chemotherapy. So in nutshell, we found that this number to be really high. So one in four patients who is receiving neoadjuvant chemotherapy is developing a VTE.
Yeah, it was very impressive. One of the things I was kind of trying to figure out, and hopefully you can help me answer this, for the high rate, such a high rate of VTE, I don't want to say surprised, but I would have expected us to start. Why aren't these patients usually anticoagulated in the first place when they're going through chemotherapy, I guess?
So we've looked at this question However, in the general oncology world, there have been few trials which have been negative in treating patients who are ambulatory and do not have a prior history of DVT-PE. Whenever they've looked at the incidence, overall incidence, the number has been roughly around 3 to 5%, but more towards the 3% range. And intervention has not been useful in these patients. There is a scoring system which we refer to in our paper as Khurana score, where Dr. Khurana, who's from Cleveland Clinic, has done a lot of research in this area. And they use a combination of a few things, mainly patients' platelet counts, white blood cell counts, the site of disease, etc., to label some patients as high risk. In our paper, we were not able to establish if that high risk criteria was predictive of DVTs, but I think some sort of metric where we can identify patients like ovarian cancer patients where the incidence is in double digits, I think intervention is warranted.
So I had a question, and this is going to reflect my maternal fetal background rather than my oncology background. Are patients who are treated with neoadjuvant therapy, my understanding is those patients are thought to have such a high disease burden that they're unlikely to be able to be optimally debulked. Is that right?
Absolutely. I think in especially in the academic centers where still the norm is that if we can achieve primary debulking, we want to do that so that we can offer patients intraperitoneal chemotherapy after that, which has been shown to have the maximal survival. But there's a definitely mechanism going on here that patients who are going into neoadjuvant chemotherapy are the ones who are either have high comorbidities or they have enormous amount of disease, which obviously both of them are factors for developing venous thromboembolic disease.
So that kind of gets me to the question. When I first started to read your paper, I wondered if it was something about the chemotherapy, the inducing chemotherapy that you give as a neoadjuvant that predisposed people, or is it the characteristics about the patient themselves? Because in your paper, I think you said there's up to a 22% rate in women treated traditionally debulking first, and this rate was 28%, I think. So, you know, maybe that's not really different, although it seems different. And is it because these are just inherently sicker patients, do you think?
Well, I think it's a combination of both, but the amount of cancer they have, generally a huge mental cake, and in some cases with stage 4 disease, when they have disease in the lung, all these patients have poor nutritional status. They do not move around as much as patients who have had surgery and are feeling better. So I think all these factors, you're absolutely right, they all merge together and increase the risk of clots in these patients.
I noticed one of the things it is very good. One of the things you called for was obviously further randomized controlled trials to try to ferret this out. Are you changing your approach at Michigan either for ovarian cancer patients in general or those that get neoadjuvant chemotherapy to start anticoagulating them prophylactically?
So we have started using Lovenox in these patients right at the outset when we decide to do neoadjuvant chemotherapy for these patients as a quality improvement project. I think the ideal thing to do, because we are now giving low molecular weight heparin for all the 9 weeks these patients are getting heparin, and it's not very desirable. But I think a nice thing to do would be a randomized controlled trial which will use newer direct oral anticoagulants. Something like Xarelto at a prophylactic dose during that time would be ideal. And I think they will also have a very high compliance as opposed to just patients who are undergoing so many different therapies and injecting themselves with one more injection every day, which is not ideal.
Sure.
But we don't have any results as of yet. We started doing this approximately a year ago, and probably within the next couple of years, we'll have some idea of whether this intervention is useful as a quality improvement or not.
Well, I can't wait to hopefully see the data come out.
I'm hoping that it's helpful, and perhaps it will serve as some sort of baseline data for convincing some mechanism of funding to fund the clinical trial.
Have you noticed any morbidity, mortality associated with using prolonged anticoagulation in this setting, or has it been relatively risk-free?
So far in our practice, we have not. Okay. Since we've worked on this paper, and I was looking for some newer data based on this while we are planning for the randomized control trial. There's one trial, again, Dr. Khurana, who I mentioned before, published a trial just recently, which was a negative trial in giving Deltaparin to patients who have a high Khurana risk score for VTE and getting chemotherapy. The trial was stopped because they had a higher risk of bleeding in patients getting Deltaparin at a prophylactic dose. But my feeling is in that paper, they also included patients who had pancreatic cancers and gastric cancers, and GI bleeds was the most common bleed. Luckily, we do not have that problem in ovarian cancer, and perhaps our study may have a benefit.
This would be just great if something can help these women. I mean, they're going through so much, and obviously they develop a VTE, even if it's a localized rather than a systemic process, it adds to their morbidity already, which is already high. So that's
absolutely great. There are several issues with the VTE. One is the cost factor. There's approximately $30,000 of cost added to every VTE episode. Plus, if this episode is happening before surgery, during the surgery, we are always concerned that how aggressive can we be, because later on we have to fully anticoagulate this person and we run a risk of having postoperative bleed in that setting. So the surgeon aggressiveness goes down. So I think from all the angles, having a clot before or after the surgery is very detrimental to quality of life and outcomes for these women.
It's always so interesting to me how a clinical observation, you all notice that it seemed like you were getting way too many clots in these women, leads to really a wonderful sort of research question. The question you asked may have been very hard to sort of get the data pieces together and do the analysis and such, but it was a very clear question, which for the young investigators and clinicians who listen to this podcast, I think is just a recurring theme in many of our editor's picks, is people have asked a clinically driven, clear question, and they've answered the question.
Thank you.
That's great.
Yeah, and I still, again, I would really like to acknowledge the work of the residents, because they've done a wonderful job in helping us answer this question.
Yep, sounds like they've had good mentorship, too.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Well, Dr. Paul, thank you so much for participating in this podcast. I really appreciate you taking the time out of, I'm sure, a very busy schedule to talk to both Dr. Cheshire and I.
Thank you very much.
Have a great day. Our second paper is by Schoen et al. And is entitled Intracervical Foley Catheter with and without oxytocin for labor induction. This was a randomized controlled trial that wanted to look at the effect of initiating labor induction with a Foley bulb and then concurrent oxytocin started at least within 60 minutes of placement, or Foley bulb alone and then waiting until either the Foley was expelled spontaneously or had been in place for at least 12 hours before starting the oxytocin. There's a good mix of both nulliparous and multiparous women in both groups. And what the authors found was that in both groups, multiparous and nulliparous women, that the Foley bulb placement with concurrent initiation of oxytocin was significantly more likely to result in delivery within 24 hours of Foley placement than those who underwent Foley alone and waiting for the oxytocin. Kind of interesting numbers. One of the things that kind of shocked me at it when I was going through the tables was the pretty high rate of cesarean section for really basically a rest of labor, even with the group that had both Foley and concurrent oxytocin, which is, you know, it goes back to talking about you want to prevent that first cesarean section so they don't get sectioned right for the rest of their lives. What do you guys do at North Carolina? Because we tend to do both Foley and oxytocin.
We try to do one or the other of Foley plus oxytocin or Foley plus meso. Mm-hmm. And there's proponents of one or the other, and no one particularly has a strong evidence base to say that of those two comparisons that one makes a difference as long as you're using both concurrently. So mm-hmm. there is a a move, particularly after this last set of papers that came out at the SMFM this past year, looking at this specific question. In fact, I think this was one of those papers, as to, you know, combining these things, does it improve outcomes? Again, you get back to exactly what you started with, is if you want to avoid the first cesarean section, one mechanism is to avoid non-indicated inductions of labor.
Right.
So rising data that says if you have a non-medically indicated induction plan, presumably at 39 weeks or later, it might be reasonable to try to defer that until a woman's cervix is ripe.
Mm-hmm.
That would be, I think, ideal, particularly if your goal is to avoid that first cesarean section, and particularly if she's nulliparous. But if you've got a medically indicated induction, it's sure nice to have improved ways of getting her safely induced.
Right. And interestingly, like you just alluded to, the rate of post-dates induction for the nulliparous was about twice as high as the percentage of the multiparous patients. So again, what you're talking about is trying to wait till the cervix is ripe, wait till there's a good time for induction rather than forcing the issue if you don't have to.
Right. It's interesting. It always, this seems like a question that we should have answered a long time ago, doesn't it? I mean, mm-hmm. We induce a lot of women, and why are we still trying to figure out this kind of a question? But I think it's because it's just a really hard question to answer, but incredibly important given how many inductions we do and what the ramifications are if it doesn't go well.
Right. And even the rate of inductions that were still going out to 24 hours, I thought was very surprisingly high. Not remembering very well my L&D days from before, but it just seemed, I'd forgotten that we do sometimes these long, long inductions that often end up just in a C-section anyway.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's would be great to have that crystal ball to know which ones are going to go well and which ones are not. But barring that, and you know, maybe the iPhone app will come out for that, I don't know. But you know, having something that at least makes it more likely that you'll get there successfully is certainly a big help.
Yeah. Well, our final paper is by Sahaz Bunda et al., and it's entitled Universal Cervical Length Screening and Antenatal Corticosteroid Timing. Okay. This is a retrospective cohort study to evaluate the relationship between universal transvaginal screening for short cervical length and the timing of antenatal corticosteroids for women between 24 and 34 weeks of gestation. And I have to admit, when I first started skimming through this and reading the paper, I was a little bit confused as to what the goal was, but then as I got into it some more, it made more sense. They divided the patients into those that they found with a short cervical length less than 2.5 centimeters and those with a normal cervical length, and they tried to see, okay, amongst those with short and normal, what was the time from initiation of steroids to delivery? And they found that among the patients that were screened to have a short cervical length, the time from initiation of steroids to ultimate delivery was longer than the patients who had the normal cervical length, who were delivered less than 7 days after initiation of steroids. I think that's where I got a little bit confused in terms of why didn't they get the steroid? Why did it take so long for them to get the steroids? And this is where I need your assistance. To me, then, it seems like what they're pointing out is that if you have a patient who you screen for short cervical length, and then comes in with anything that even smells of preterm labor, she's going to get steroids whether or not she needs them. And that may not be the best thing ultimately for the baby, correct?
I believe that's the conclusion here.
Yes. Okay. Interesting way of finding it. So I almost would talk against universal screening for short cervix.
Except for they showed that there was no difference in neonatal outcomes.
True.
And the women who didn't have a short cervix, who came in with symptoms, were probably more likely to be in more advanced labor.
Yeah, and that was one of the problems in figuring the paper out. They didn't discuss those types of issues. They just, the basic data points were screened for short cervical length and then steroids and time to delivery.
Right. You know, in a way, I think the screening for short cervix is in asymptomatic women without a history helps you to be alert to the likelihood ratios, the background risk of a woman actually being in real labor when she comes in.
Okay.
You know, that's always the problem, is you've got a woman who's even at term, is she really in labor or not when she shows up? But
sure.
Certainly in preterm patients, we know that 50% of women or more who come in with regular contractions and an intact bag of waters will be home, sent home undelivered, and will deliver near their due date.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you can tip the balance into predicting that women who show up in your triage area with preterm contractions are more or less likely to actually be in real labor
mm-hmm.
or to deliver within the next 7 days or whatever the metric is that you're going to measure that by, then you can more readily and accurately provide interventions like steroids or magnesium sulfate for CNS prophylaxis, those sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
So my take home on this is that even though the time difference was longer, what that told me is people were not typically just giving steroids at 24 weeks. Presumably that's the end point where cervix screening was done. So you've got a lady at 24 weeks and she's got a short cervix, otherwise asymptomatic. People are not just going ahead and giving her steroids.
Right.
They're waiting until they show up with, you know, something else. But at that point, they're quick to give them, is the way they're more likely to give them at that point, because she's got a previous risk factor, just like you would take a woman with a previous preterm birth.
Mm-hmm.
Shows up at 26 weeks with contractions, you're going to treat her differently than a woman with contractions at 26 weeks with two previous term births.
Right.
So it's just another risk factor, kind of the way that I looked at that at this paper.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it would be interesting to know, and this is all background that unfortunately is not available in the paper, amongst those women who did not have a short cervix when they did come in with their preterm labor symptomatology. Did they have a shorter cervix at that point in time, and could that have tripped the clinicians into steroids?
Yeah, it's a good point, because that, you know, as you said, isn't what they studied. This was universal second trimester transvaginal ultrasound screening, not screening for the woman who's there in labor or rule out labor.
Right.
You know, with certainly some people do.
That would probably be the next step in this, is to take those with the short cervix and see, okay, how did they present, and how did they present when they came in with their preterm labor evaluation?
Mm-hmm. I think that would be an important thing to add to this.
Well, Dr. Cheshire, thank you again for another very interesting discussion, and I look forward to talking to you again next month, and hopefully we can find another author to include in next month's discussion.
Yeah, we'll have to make sure Dr. Upshaw lets people know that we didn't bite.
Yes, we were very friendly this time.
Dr. Fisher, I just wanted to thank you again. I mean, since you've been doing this podcast with me, is this 2 years now, about?
Just about a year.
Just about a year.
Time flies when you're having fun.
You've been doing this with me for about a year. You've brought lots of great innovations already.
Thank you.
We've got music, we've got better sound quality, we've got authors who are way more interesting than I am to talk to, and some great questions and continued great topics to talk about. So thanks so much.
You're very welcome. You have a good month.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to Green Journal Editor's Picks. As always, we appreciate your feedback. Please contact me at jfischer, that's J-F-I-S-C-H-E-R, at greenjournal.org, with your comments, suggestions, or questions that I can ask Dr. Cheshire for our next edition. Have a great day!